It's dangerous.
We need to make videos that children literally can't look away from.
I know the difference between swimming and flying. Pew, pew, pew,
pew, pew. I'm shocked, Brennan, that you would do that.
Hello, Indonesia.
The ocean's not for us.
I'm Hank Green.
And I'm Brennan Lee Mulligan.
And this is Ask Hank Anything. Hello, I'm Hank Green, and I love it when people ask me questions because then I get to learn about the world. So I made a show that's like an interview show but reverse, where people come and ask me questions and then I can learn about them from the questions they choose to ask. Today I am joined by Brennan Lee Mulligan, multi-talented writer, performer, dungeon master. You have likely seen him on the internet being adorable and fun. You've seen him on Game Changer. You've seen him on Make Some Noise. You've seen him on Dimension 20. You have seen him on a show I was on, Dimension 20 I was on, called Mentopolis.
Mentopolis, that's right.
Being on that show, dream come true. Wow. Also, I got to see how hard you work.
Yeah.
You're not messing around.
No.
It's amazing.
Thank you.
Just the amount of work that went into all of it before.
The Dimension 20, by virtue of being an anthology show, has a lot of takeoffs and landings. And
And it was only like a 7-episode show, and you did so much work.
So much work. Imagine if we had gotten to stay there for 30 or 50 or 100 or 200 episodes.
Yeah.
But we don't, and that's the fun.
Yeah. We killed the people we needed to kill, and then we're good. We did
off
it.
Off you go. You did your inner mind film noir, and it was a joy and a privilege and an honor.
It was so smart. It was so smart.
Thanks.
And also, that wasn't the only idea you had. You pitched a bunch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are other ones. There's still some on the back burner. They're ready for later.
Well, it's always really nice to be in the same room as you.
It's really nice. I've been looking forward to the shoot for quite some time.
Oh,
and this is really exciting. I think it's a great concept for a show, and I have a lot of burning questions that I need answered.
You do. And you got it perfect because you gave me like a silly and a serious and a silly and a serious, and we get to do the whole thing. That's how I like to do it.
Bingo, bango. Your boy knows content.
So this first question is an easy one. Do you want to do our first easy one? I actually had a lot of fun with this.
Oh, great.
And I had an answer for it immediately.
Yes.
Which I think is the top easiest answer. But I have to go through four potential answers before I get to the good one. Here's your first question. I do not do this off the top of my head. I do a lot of research.
You do a lot of
research?
Just
so people know.
Yes.
Sometimes people are like, how does he know everything?
Mm-hmm. Aha. A noise that exemplifies sudden realization or catharsis, and also the acronym for Ask Hank Anything.
He got it on the first try.
It's a great title. They say you should always punch a shark in the nose.
I mean, they don't say you should always do it. Only when it's attacking you.
They say you should always...
You shouldn't go out of your way to...
You should find sharks and punch them in the nose. It's also not a nose. It's just the front of their head.
Well...
It's just a pointy front of their head, right?
You know, but you know.
Yeah, I hear you.
We're going to talk about that, actually.
Sometimes they... I mean, we have not gotten through the question, but we're already off to the races. This just... They have... It's not their fault they have a cone-shaped front of head.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's a nose, but is it?
It's a sensitive part of the body for them.
The cone?
Yeah.
So they say you should always be punching sharks in the nose. What is the worst type of animal to punch in the nose?
So, first answer, a human baby. So, you're definitely
you took
not...
worst in a moral direction.
It's bad for everybody, right?
It's bad
for the baby. It's bad for you.
Bad for your immortal soul.
Bad for your soul. Bad for your freedom. You know, because you're probably going to go to jail about that.
Yeah, for sure.
You shouldn't punch a baby in the nose.
I don't think there's anywhere that they just are cool with punching babies.
No.
Yeah, for sure.
And my first thought was any baby, but like a human baby would be worse. Obviously, very bad to punch a kitten in the nose.
I guess if you
very bad to punch like a baby whale.
Yeah.
In the nose.
Yeah, I guess if you... I'm trying to think of the worst possible baby to punch
as a human, because that's the only one you, like, that's the highest prosecution level.
Yeah, that is true, and I think you are right. Maybe there's a universe where it's, like, the last red panda baby. Where you are guaranteed...
Like, it's got to be a cute animal that's about to go extinct.
It's a cute animal that's about to go extinct.
Not just any animal that's about to go extinct.
And it's like they have one other, but these two need to grow up into a mating pair.
Yeah.
And you plow. And then you go, oops.
But what if I punched it?
Yeah, and then maybe especially it's
let
like...
Let the intrusive thoughts win. I don't know.
You're like, that red panda knows what it did. But no, that makes sense. Human baby is the right answer.
Okay, but I actually don't think... So I don't think that's what you meant. So we're going to keep going.
Okay.
Number two are animals that would break your hand if you punched them. So they probably wouldn't even notice, like a rhinoceros.
Wow, yes.
So punch a rhinoceros in the nose. Rhinoceros probably is like, that's fine, honestly. Whatever I was going to do to you, I'm still going to do to you. but I don't think it increases the odds that the rhinoceros kills you, but you did break your hand.
I also think it's depending on where you punch it. If you're punching straight down, you've impaled your hand on the horn.
Yeah.
They mean
it's rhino, a bad nose to punch.
Rhino is Greek for nose, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
It sure is. They just named that guy Nose.
I mean, it's like Mickey the Nose. Naming stuff's hard.
So that's a category. Things where right. you just break your hand. There's another category where you break your hand and then the animal also comes and kills you, like a gorilla.
Yeah.
So you punch a gorilla in the face. It's not going to do that much damage to the gorilla. Will do damage to your hand. And then the gorilla will tear your arms off. Mm-hmm. Because it will interpret that action in the spirit it was intended, yeah. which is you have attacked me, now I will attack you.
I did ask a question about gorillas. I'm not sure if it made the cut.
Oh, did you?
I did. What I did ask it? A question about gorillas. There was a meme for a minute that's no longer topical.
Yeah.
I'm sure it got cut, but yes, it was too topical.
Too topical.
But I asked, I think, an even braver question. Mm-hmm. Everybody was talking about what would weigh between 100 men or one gorilla. I had the clarity, vision, and foresight to ask who would win, one man or 100 gorillas.
I probably should have kept it in because
we got there eventually.
The 100 gorillas would do it.
Prove it.
They would. All right. Somebody get 100 gorillas.
Yeah. And you can't source 100 gorillas, so we will never know.
Yeah. What does the man have with him?
A song in his heart.
Okay.
Spring in his step and a song in his heart and a will to survive. Maybe he's got Eye of the Tiger playing.
The gorillas also have a will to survive. So the thing, I have it for you. The thing that it is the worst to punch in the nose.
Okay.
Because it has in it toxins.
Oh, no.
That there is no anti-venom to.
Okay.
That are called conotoxins. They're small peptides. And it has enough of it, even though it's quite a small animal, to kill you. A little bit of body horror coming up. So if you want to skip forward, that's fine. Doing paralysis. So what happens is you stay conscious, but your diaphragm stops working. So you just...
Can't breathe.
And so this animal has killed a number of people. The harpoon comes out of its proboscis, which I'm counting as a nose.
You just said the harpoon, like we've been talking about a harpoon for a couple of
There's
minutes.
A tiny little tooth that's like a harpoon that shoots out of it at like lightning speed. I can't tell you how fast. And it eats fish. So it shoots fish, gives them this toxin, and then it
I can't even
them.
Imagine the creature we're talking about. What is this thing?
Well, I have it for you.
Don't! It's dangerous!
It's dead.
Oh my God.
That is the worst thing, I think, to punch in the nose. It's called a geography cone. It's a kind of cone snail.
We were just talking about how hard it is to name stuff. Buddy, that's not a good name for this. A geography cone?
I didn't
cone?
Actually look up why. That's terrible. It's super on me. I did not look up why they call it the geography
the
cone.
The thing that kills you on contact, everyone's being like, there's a little shelled monster that kills you on contact. And someone goes, like geography. Got it. Okay.
I don't know. I actually, like, in my head, and I don't know if this is the reason, but I thought it's because, like, it kind of looks like a globe. Like, they all have different patterns on them.
Yeah. But anyway. If you're going to say that looks like a map, then I guess so does everything. You know what I mean? Like, I get it. There's different blobs, and the blobs could be land masses.
I brought you a better one. So this one will do damage, but like a bee sting, and that's like a leopard cone snail.
Oh,
so you can see that because it has spots.
Wow.
So I brought you those to have. So if you punch it in the proboscis, it could shoot out its little harpoon and there's a chance that you would die. Like a not insignificant one. And like the fact that there's no anti-venom for it is wild to me.
That really is good to know. And if I had seen one of these in the ocean, I would have been like delightful. And now I know and have once again reconfirmed that the ocean's not for us. Jacques, all due respect, get out of there, man.
Yeah.
Horrifying. Thank you for these. Thank you for the dead bodies of these poisonous creatures.
Yes. It's just the skeletons, I think.
Just the skeletons.
If you have a different idea about what the worst thing to punch in the nose would be, leave them in the comments. I accept that this is a subjective question.
Yeah. Okay. Question answered. Now I know I won't punch geography cones. And I won't.
You can just call them geography.
Geography.
I won't punch geography.
If you see something that looks like a map. Now, again, if you look at that and you go, now that's a map. You're like, I live in a series of regimented islands.
That's not a geography cone.
Oh, gotcha, gotcha. Okay.
That's a leopard cone because it has spots.
Gotcha.
Which leopards have. Mm-hmm. All right. This is Puzzle the Pelican. Can you pick another question from Puzzle the Pelican's pouch?
When did it start to feel like science and technology were two separate things? And am I crazy, or does it feel like they have started to appeal to and attract the interest of very different types of people? I got shit I'm thinking right now.
I think this is also a subjective one, but I looked
into this.
And it seems like a while ago. So definitely there was a time when science and technology were very closely tied together. Like Galileo isn't just looking at the sky and writing down when Jupiter's moons are doing stuff. He's like helping to build the telescope.
Right.
And he's like working on that and refining that and trying to figure out what the limitations of it are and making real stuff.
Yes.
And so like the technologists and the scientists are kind of the same people. They're making things. We've got people testing out and trying to understand thermodynamics at the same time that they're building steam engines.
Yeah.
So like, but that is kind of the moment where it splits.
Yeah.
Like Industrial Revolution times, where you start to see people who are like, these are the new tools that we have access to. How do we use these tools to do great things, build big things, make lots of money, become very powerful, and solve lots of problems?
Yeah.
And that split, you see happen also in academia, where you start to have departments of science versus departments of engineering. You start to have schools that are like institutes of technology, like MIT, that are more about like engineering and practical, like doing of stuff, and schools that are more about curiosity-led, don't really care what this does, just trying to figure out stuff about the world kinds of science. And then, you know, even today, of course, these things overlap, where you've got like CRISPR being developed academically, and then you've got those same people who developed it being technologists. Jennifer Doudna is like doing both of those things. But you do like at the Industrial Revolution, you see that split, and that split happens. And like physically too, where you've got like CERN in Switzerland doing slow peer review, trying to suss out the sort of fundamental nature of the universe. And you've got Silicon Valley, which is like founders and exits and venture capital and like very led by the impact of it all on people. And how do we have the like big impact on people? Ideally, because they want to have these things in the world that's going to help them do things.
And that's what you think's happening.
Ideally, that would be what they would think.
They're saying, yeah.
Like we will provide services and products that people will want and use and enjoy.
Yeah, or products that we can con them into buying. It is a wild thing.
You're right, it attracts very different kinds of people.
Well, that's the part that is so wild to me is, like when I was growing up, it was like, oh, science and technology be like, I wouldn't like, maybe not synonymous, but close enough to be like, oh yeah, like gadgets and gizmos. And
I still think for a lot of people, like if you look at it from far enough away, that it still does look like that. What I'm worried about, and I think what you are right to identify here, is if these things get set up oppositionally, which it seems like some people now.
I would say that it feels like that's where we're.
People like want them to be set up oppositionally. So if enough people in the sort of technologist world are saying, ugh, those science people are such elitists and they don't care about the actual impact on the world. And then the people in the science world are like, oh, those people, they're so reckless and they're so fast moving. And like they separate completely and start to be oppositional.
Yeah.
I think that this is happening. And I think it is very bad.
Well,
and you can identify some of these people saying things like Elon Musk recently, like there's no such thing as an AI researcher. It's all engineers.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, you're saying that because you don't like research.
Yeah.
You don't like the way research works, which is about trying to figure out truths. You just like doing things.
Well, and also fundamentally, these CEOs posit themselves as a bunch of Tony Starks when what they are is salesmen.
Yeah.
You know, like these are more or less like, I mean, the idea of, I mean, I just read something, again, I'd be interested in your anecdotal take on this, but I mean, it was a very compelling bon mot, which was someone basically saying, if they had a machine that could write blockbuster screenplays with pressing a button, they wouldn't be trying to sell it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially with the idea of whatever the larger thing is going on here is, it does feel like every day I open a news article and I see the one woman studying a type of frog that could maybe cure cancer has been stuffed into a rocket ship and fired into the sun by the current administration.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile,
yeah.
A guy has come and said, I have a way for you to download my app to park your own car at your own house. And you go, that's hell. And he goes, no, it's a great innovation.
Yeah.
And you go, you are a con artist. You're twiddling your mustache right now.
And because the people who are in academia are sort of like government funded, like there isn't a way to easily turn it into money. And the people who are in selling stuff are the richest people on Earth.
Yeah.
Or who have ever existed on Earth. In many ways, the most powerful people. I mean, I'd say.
Yeah.
As a proportion of like individual wealth.
Well, it's a little hard because like there were times when kings were kings, you know, and there was like absolute power, divine right, and that kind of thing. But like a huge amount of power, huge amount of like ability to define what's real, you know? Yeah. Like that's like a lot of when people are like asking AI a question about like, is this real?
Yeah.
Like, what's the answer to this question? It's like the people who train those systems are kind of starting to define reality. And that's why you see like different AI systems set up differently to define reality differently, which is really scary. Already that was happening with the way that the algorithms feed us content. The level of power there means that that group of people is going to have more access, going to have more influence, especially on politicians.
That makes a ton of sense. There's been a long argument on a moral level against the existence of billionaires. And I think there's actually more recently been a very different argument, which is basically the argument of like, hey, these guys are superhuman. Like on a level of the distribution of power, regardless of your moral measurement of these people, it would be like, there's a kid that can blow up the world with his mind. You know, like it's like, should that type of power be concentrated in a single individual? It's a great, I think like Sam Sater had a great thing that he talked about, essentially being like, you know, even the well-meaning, it's like back in the 90s, like Bill and Melinda Gates, it's like, oh, we're going to change how the United States education system works.
Yeah.
And you go, is that your call?
Do you know that?
Do you know
more
that?
More than other people? Like, and is that your expertise?
Is that your expertise? But it's like for a billionaire, it gets to be because they have the power to make it so. Mm-hmm. And I think that's wrong.
So what this question clarified for me is that it's actually very important to try and bridge this gap, to have people who are in academia thinking about and doing stuff with the engineers, to have the engineers thinking about and building bridges with the academia, or else if these things are set up oppositionally, it makes no sense to set them up oppositionally.
Yeah.
It's like very, very good for these things to work in concert with each other, especially because if you don't put science as part of it, it is so easy to just blunder straight forward into massive mistakes.
Well, that's the thing, is that the technology is not necessarily at issue other than, is there anything to the idea about looking at technology as a sphere of economic activity and looking at science as a sphere of economic activity? It feels like an assumption that I would arrive at, that technology offers quicker means to short-term profit. So as a result of that, it seems like I would say that the you know, if you're talking about bridging the gap between the engineers and the scientists, that the issue is that technology has been captured by forces of privatization. That fundamentally it's like, yeah, if all of these great engineers are turned to the task of being like, we need to make videos that children literally can't look away from. Don't worry, I assume their brains will be fine. You know, like, like capturing that for profit motive is the thing that makes you go like, make sure that the children literally cannot shut their eyes lest they miss a single instant. This is the, you know, there've been studies about like some of the engineers that have worked on like, you know, AI slop or child education. There's like, you know, YouTube videos that are, they're horrifying.
Yeah.
But again, it's like you're saying, it's not necessarily anything intrinsic to being an engineer or a technologist. But I think if you are captured by those like venture capital forces.
Because there's this idea that like the surrogate for the value you create is the money that you generate. And like your investors are definitely going to want you to believe that.
Totally. Yeah. An old friend of mine who's a great, wise mentor of mine said, if the only lens through which you can view life is value in currency, that which is priceless becomes worthless.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Beautiful. And really scary.
Yeah.
We gotta stop them.
Good question.
Thank you.
That was a really sticky one. I'm gonna be thinking about it for a long time.
I appreciate that. Thanks, Hank. How fast would I need to flap my arms to fly? And would my arms be okay afterward?
This is not an easy thing to calculate, it turns out. But we tried. We did our best.
Really?
Yeah. So we looked at how pterosaurs flap, because they're a big, heavy thing that flaps and flies. For a pterosaur to fly, it's something like a little bit under a flap a second. Mm-hmm. And they're not quite as heavy as you and I. I don't know how much you weigh, but I'm guessing.
I come out around 200.
Yeah.
Pterosaurs are a little bit lighter than me.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
We have to 550 pounds.
Holy shit.
Ooh, Doctor, 550 pounds. Getting up there.
That, yeah.
Woo! Big old boy!
So they can be bigger, but what they have that you don't have is a lot of surface area in the arms.
Yes.
So we looked at the surface area of just the bottom part of your arm. So like if you were a hummingbird, you might be doing a little bit of like a little bit of this and then down. That's nice. Like that, a lot of our surface area is just in this part, so it's not just the hands.
Yeah.
So you're gonna have to basically do a pterosaur flap, like one of these, where you pull it in, like you're treading water, and then push down.
Oh yeah.
So you're decreasing your drag on the way up, and then you increase your drag on the way down. So that's a big, lot of movement flap.
Yeah.
And you're gonna have to do that from our very rough calculations, like 100 times a second, which is faster than hummingbird wings.
So I need to flap my arms faster than
hummingbird, and also do this whole thing. So not just like this.
Okay. I don't want to say that I feel like you're attacking me or making me try to lose hope, but
So there's a fair amount of raining on parades in this show. And this parade.
Let's talk about how it can work, not how it can't work. That's okay. Okay. So I would need to flap my arms faster than a hummingbird wing in a crazier way than they do.
I could totally make it work for you.
Okay.
So here's how you make it work. You make the air much, much more dense.
Easy.
The density of water. And then you get in that air and you just sort of flap and you push around and you...
Are you trying to trick me into swimming? I know the difference between swimming and flying. Hey, I'm trying to talk about flying.
What is the difference between swimming and flying?
In one, you're wet. I don't want to be wet. I want to get up in the dry sky.
One thing that I just a true thing I love is that fish are basically flying in water.
Hey,
And birds are just using the air as if it is water.
Yes, but I will say something I have often seen fish do is stop. And I have never seen a bird stop.
Hummingbirds can stop.
Well, they are putting a lot more work into stopping than a fish is. A fish just slows down.
And it's like,
what's up, baby? And a hummingbird is like, again, a hummingbird is like, you can't see my wings right.
Water is very thick air. So that's the difference. It's just the thickness of the air.
I want a headshot where you look extremely professorial and academic, and it says, water is just thick air.
Water is just thick air. They're both fluids. People get mad at when I like offhandedly as like, I know too much, overeducated guy, I call air a fluid. But air is a fluid in that it flows.
Is there no thing that is a gas in that case?
No. So gases are fluids.
Gases are fluids. Are solids fluids?
They're not liquids. Solids are not fluids because they don't flow.
Mm.
See?
Yet. Everything melts.
T-1000.
Yes. Okay. So what I'm hearing is...
I fixed it. You can fly. Just get in the water.
This is like that thing.
Don't tell me I didn't do it. I did it.
I did it. This is like that thing where you're like, Dad, can we do a puppet show? And he looks over at some sandwich bags and goes, sure, we can do a puppet show.
We've got flying at home. It's swimming.
Flying at home and it's swimming. Fine, I accept. I still think if I could do it a couple thousand times a second, surely I could get up off the ground.
No, you could. All you have to do is flap 100 times a second.
Flap 100 times a second. Great.
You could totally do it.
And my arms would be okay.
No, your arms would not be okay. My son, I asked him and he said, probably not. Your arms would be moving like so fast they would be on fire.
Okay.
And I actually didn't do the math to see if you'd have to like burn ATP so fast that they would like ignite or like the pressure of the air, like, you know, like a reentry into the atmosphere.
But if
what was that word you just said?
Would my skin catch on fire?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But if it did, then heat rises.
Yeah.
And so I'm getting up even faster.
Like hot boy.
I'm my own hot air balloon.
Yeah, like one of those lanterns.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I love it. Maybe that's what the Human Torch is doing. Maybe he's flapping.
So hot.
Flapping. You're so hot right now. All right, fine. Swimming. Good. I did it.
Swimming.
I'll swim. What are the biggest crises or disasters that humanity and perhaps human science in particular has successfully averted in the past 50 years?
So I started out and I was like, I got a couple of these in my head. And then I like did some searching and I was like, oh, more than I thought.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Dodging bullets out here.
So one of the big ones that I had not thought about is just getting way better at disaster preparedness. So like in the 1970s, there was a big tropical cyclone in Southeast Asia, could easily kill hundreds of thousands of people. Now the storms are stronger and there are more people living on the coast. So you would think more than 100,000 people, more like maybe millions of people. But in fact, often now the death tolls are under 100 because the buildings are built better, the systems preparing for disasters are better. And this is basically from an innovation that does not sound like an innovation, which is simply people dying in disasters are not the fault of disasters. They are the fault of human systems.
Wow.
And if the human systems can be built in such a way that you survive the disaster, then the disaster is still like a, you know, an infrastructural problem and people will die, but you could have thousands times fewer people dying.
Hundreds of thousands to under 100 in 50 years.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And this is also the case with like earthquake preparedness. We're just way better at that stuff. And of course, you see if an earthquake hits a place that does not have good disaster infrastructure. And also, importantly, we tend, even now, we only count people who die in the disaster as the people who are killed by the disaster, but not the people who die because they don't get health care during the period of the disaster or during recovery. You know, sometimes water systems get broken and you can get people with cholera and those people die. You don't count the cholera victims as victims of the disaster, even though they wouldn't have died without the disaster. And that can be many times in excess of the people who die in the actual disaster. By looking at all of that complex, kind of boring stuff, so many people who would have died and have no idea that their lives were saved are still alive right now. And like, people are not orphans. People didn't lose their children. You know, like, this is... And like, people don't know. Like, this is the crazy thing about all this preventative work that we do. People just don't know when they don't die.
Yeah.
That's like another way where science like does amazing and magnificent and extremely impactful work, and it's just invisible.
It's happening in the aggregate. It's happening in these like a million individual contributions to like bring... Like,
same thing with like air pollution. Millions of people are alive today who would not otherwise be because of air pollution regulations. We don't think about them at all.
Because... if I die, it's somebody's fault. And if I live, I'm killing it.
Exactly. Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Which is like completely understandable. But there are also some like fun ones that are like less hiding in the details. So Y2K, you know how much money we spent not having Y2K happen?
How much?
$100 billion.
Woo! That's a lot of money.
So
in 1999 dollars.
I actually don't know if it is. I read that, and I don't know if it was adjusted for inflation or not.
Copy that.
But it could have been.
It could have been.
But either way, it's a lot. Even today, that's a lot of money.
Even today, that's
a lot. I don't have that.
Yeah, I don't know how much I think inflation has gone up in the past 25 years. It's gone up a lot.
Yeah.
Tough.
So Y2K didn't happen.
Yeah.
We have, smallpox eradication happened in the last 50 years, wildly enough.
Wild.
And nobody has died of smallpox since the 1980s.
Crazy.
After it being one of the greatest scourges of all mankind. We did the ozone thing with CFCs. We fixed that. Acid rain. We had a big, like I was growing up, all the trees on the hills were dying because they were getting rained on by acid. That's not a thing anymore. Fix that.
Damn.
Like the US and Europe really led on that, where like we created systems that then got adopted all over the place because it was so successful. For not just the technology to capture the sulfur dioxide as it came out of the smokestacks, but also the way to incentivize the creation of that technology and the implementation of that technology through like trading schemes.
Remember acid rain? Remember the hole in the ozone layer? All those systems are so beautiful. I survived many years ago a horrifying high-speed car accident.
Huh.
I was driving 85 miles an
hour. A lot of disaster, like the slow-moving disaster of automobile deaths, yeah.
Car flipped. We went off the highway upside down, and we got out, and we were all surrounded. I had glass in my arm and stuff bleeding, but we crawled out. And a friend of mine was like, it's a miracle. This is a miracle. And I looked down, and the thing that the car had gouged a hole in was this thing you see on a lot of interstates, which was this giant gravel ditch on the side of highways. And I looked at it, and I was like, it's not a miracle.
They did that on purpose.
They did that on
purpose. There was somebody whose job it was to figure out the best way, or a bunch of people whose job it was to figure out the best way to prevent, not as like a car builder, but as a highway builder to prevent deaths.
Researchers, highway builders, all the guys that actually smashed up the rocks and put them on the side of the road. Like all of that, every one of those people I ever meet saved my life.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Totally awesome. And then there was SARS 2003, which was a respiratory virus, which was really infectious. We put a lid on it. And imagine how bad it would be if one of those got out.
Be pretty bad. Might make people go do some really ill-advised political things.
Oh, brother.
All right. Well, glad we got SARS nailed down.
It actually probably would have been even worse. So
wow. Man. Damn. That is very cool that we locked that down.
Yeah.
Without being sad, is it, what was the thing that made us lock down SARS?
You know, I thought about this a bunch, and there's a bunch to it, yeah. But not enough that I feel comfortable telling you right now, so it's going to be answered by future Hank.
Hello, it is future Hank. This one's going to be a bit longer than average. From 2002 to 2004, there was an outbreak of sudden acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS. It started in China, it spread to Taiwan, Vietnam, it showed up even as far as Toronto, and it was very bad. But we were able to control this disease, and it did not become a pandemic. This disease was very infectious, roughly as infectious as the virus that causes COVID, but the death rate was much worse. COVID's pre-vaccination fatality rate was about 0.5% to 1%, and the SARS fatality rate was 5% to 10%. So what was the difference here? And did we like super screw up COVID in some way? Well, it pretty much all came down to one thing, and it was a difference between the viruses. Symptoms of illness in SARS overlapped with and preceded peak viral production and thus contagiousness, while for COVID, it was the opposite. There's actually a physiological reason. The 2003 SARS virus found a more comfortable home largely in the lower respiratory tract, which makes it more dangerous, but also means that the moment the body starts churning out a bunch of viral particles, the immune system starts kicking into gear. In the typical SARS case, by the time the patient was most contagious, they had been fatigued, coughing, sneezing, and had had a fever for, on average, over a week. And that made it relatively easy, not easy, but relatively easy to identify cases and lock them down. Meanwhile, the virus that causes COVID mostly replicates in the upper respiratory tract, like right up in the nose. And those tissues are much more resilient, and the immune response there is a lot less intense and slower. So for the 2003 SARS, you were mostly contagious when you felt most sick, while for COVID, people are most contagious before they feel sick. Now, we did not know this for quite a while, but after doing a bunch of research, we have determined that roughly half of all COVID transmission happens before people experience symptoms. This is why, like, a society scale lockdown became necessary, because we couldn't just lock down sick people, because well people, people who felt well, were transmitting the virus. And this made controlling COVID much, much harder. Importantly, though, this is not something we knew at the beginning. There was only one way to discover whether we could control the spread of COVID, and that was to try, which we did. But we failed. What it comes down to is that disease to disease, symptoms correlate differently with viral load and contagiousness, and COVID has very high contagiousness in pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic cases, which has been very bad for the world. Also, this video is brought to you by Rocket Money. Whether you're looking to stay more on top of your finances or are thinking about new habits you want to commit to this year, Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you create custom budgets, cancel unwanted subscriptions, and manage your money more effectively, all in one place. Rocket Money can help you keep track of your expenses. It can automatically sort all of your transactions into various categories and then provide you with personalized insights to help you uncover spending habits and help you understand where your money is going. From there, you can easily set up a budget or even set individual spending goals by each category. You can also set up real-time alerts for large transactions, refunds, upcoming bills, new subscriptions, and low balances. These tools give you a bird's eye view of your finances in a single app with both high-level and in-depth insights. Rocket Money does all the hard work for you. Rocket Money is free to download, but you can get a free premium trial when you sign up with my link. Go to rocketmoney.com/askhank or scan the QR code. I will also put a link in the description. All right, what we got?
All right, puzzle. Let's see what's going on.
If you dug a hole straight through the earth until you came out the other side, and I jumped in the hole, what would happen? What would I need to do in order to survive the trip and ideally pop out the other side safe and sound, ready to seize the day?
Okay, you gotta do a lot. It's real hot. So, like, first of all, we're gonna ignore the part where we gotta dig the hole, because we can't do that. So we're just gonna pretend we dug the hole.
Can't do that or won't do that.
Can't do it.
Dig.
Just keep digging. So the problem with keeping digging is that it gets really hot and it melts whatever you're digging with. So there is a company actually that wants to dig and is doing this. And so instead of using a physical digger to dig, which will like eventually like the heads break and you have to pull the whole thing up and replace it. And then as you go deeper, that happens more and more because of the heat and the consistency of the rock. Instead, what do you think they're doing? How else would you do it? Just be Brennan Lee Mulligan. You can't use a physical shovel.
Shovels keep melting. Uh-huh. Drills keep melting. Uh-huh. Machines keep melting. Uh-huh. Here's what I'd do. Go to outer space. Enormous laser.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
You don't go to outer space, but yeah, laser.
You don't even have yeah. space. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Nah, you can do it from right here. Plow, 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 plow.
Yeah, they use like very high energy.
Whoa.
They just like shoot energy at the ground and it evaporates.
Awesome. Sick. Nailed it. You hear that? I am good at science. The humanities have a lot to offer. Sick. Okay. Yeah. Laser. Great. Uh-huh. All right, we're going to get this hole dug in no time. Now, yeah. how do I pop in there and glide through the hole in the earth, pop out safe and sound on the other side?
First, you got to have some way of managing the heat, because even like there's going to be infrared radiation shining at you from every direction as you get down there at the core. So you basically have to line this thing with something that is going to block all of that heat. That's going to be a really big structure. But look,
could I do like a double bag some of those lava suits?
Look, what you could do is you could put the wall around you and have like a water cooled situation somehow.
Cool.
That you're just like wearing a very good spacesuit.
Okay.
Which is also like going to be important because the atmospheric pressure will either be very high at the bottom. So basically air will rush in to fill this hole. There'll be all of the air stacked up on top of it up to, you know, the top of the atmosphere. That'll be very high atmospheric pressure. And that might not be great for you. So you might want to wear a suit to prevent that from happening.
Gotcha.
But this is a bigger problem if there's a bunch of air in the hole, because there's so much air in the hole that it will slow you down. As you approach the center of the earth, gravity will decrease and the air resistance will also increase. And those two effects together means that it's going to take like more than a week to get there. To get to the center. And then you only overshoot by a little bit and you come right back and you just hang. And then you got a big climb ahead of you.
Okay, this is actually feeling intuitive and I'm getting what the issue is. Okay, so I'm shooting down the hole.
Mm-hmm.
I got 20 miles of air on top.
You're going fast.
I'm going fast. We got the hole dug. I'm in my anti-heat suit. I look like a little astronaut shooting down. There's a lot of air pressure with, you know, we can feel the air pressure difference in Vail Pass versus Sinai,
right. And like terminal velocity is going to be defined by the amount of air that you're falling through.
Right. Cause how long does it take to fall a couple miles, 32 feet per second? So people that do parachuting, that do like skydiving, it takes a little while, even free falling, to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And the distance from high in the atmosphere to the earth is so much shorter than one side of the planet.
Thick air in there. And so your terminal velocity is going to keep getting lower and lower and lower.
It's going to get lower even. Now, I would have assumed it stays fast, fast, fast until I hit the center point. Is it going to start slowing down before then?
Oh, yeah, because of the air resistance. So as there's more air and there's less gravity, you are going to slow down as you approach the center.
There's less gravity as you get more into the center.
Yeah.
Because there's more junk behind you.
Yeah.
Damn, I didn't think of that. This is why you have to talk to the experts before you try something. Okay, so what I need, it sounds like, and I'm picking up what you're laying down, I got to get a running start.
Like, trebuchet me into the hole.
Yes, and here's what we do. This, I knew I was going to have to go to space. You go to space, I squirrel suit from space. I already got the heat shield to survive in the planet core.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go tippy top past terminal velocity. I have to go Mach 3.
You're going to slow down and the air's going to slow you down. I have a solution for the problem. Okay. If you want to hear my solution.
What's the solution?
You have to build an airlock on either side of the hole. Pump all of the air out of the hole until it's a perfect vacuum. And then have you ever been on like that, one of those water slides where the bottom drops out? The Der Stuka?
No, what is this?
It's a water slide where you're just like standing in a thing and then it's like boop, 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 dunk, and the bottom drops out and you shoot down the water slide.
Oh my God, that sounds so
fun. So it's going to be like that. You're going to be in your little spacesuit. You're going to be standing on a platform and it's going to evacuate all the air inside of your chamber. So you get in there and they're going to pump all the air out and then they drop you in. There's no air, so no air resistance. You will have enough energy that you'll blow past the middle point.
Okay.
And then you will start to slow down as you move all the way through. And then you will have, if you do it at areas that are like basically precisely the same elevation.
Yeah.
So like at sea level, or maybe you want to start above sea level and end up at sea level just for any tiny bit of air molecules that might still be in there slowing you down.
Yeah.
And then you arrive, you got to turn yourself over halfway through so that you're facing the right way. You get there, you pop right up, and then the trapdoor closes under your feet and you land and you did it.
That's how we did it. Let's do that. I may not turn over halfway through because I may want to land in a handstand for dramatic effect.
Do it. You got it.
Hello, Indonesia. I assume that will be other side of the planet from where.
There's not a lot of places where you can actually make an Earth sandwich. You know what I'm talking about.
I know about the Earth. Baby, yeah. I'm right there with you. I know the Earth sandwich.
Yeah. There's not a lot of places that's actually land on both sides, which makes it tricky. But a
lot of ocean out there.
Sure, you could go straight into the ocean. And then you could be flying.
God damn it.
Okay, we have two more questions.
See the big question card.
Oh, this is the, you asked a question that was too big for a card. I'm shocked, Brennan, that you would do that. Here's the big question card.
Big questions, net big answers.
I don't even have an answer for this one. I just want to talk about it.
One of the greatest advantages of our species is our ability to spread out amongst disciplines and gain and share specialized knowledge with each other that no one person could accumulate by themselves. However, it feels like there are strong cultural forces that seek to attack and diminish the value both of experts and even the very concept of expertise. How do we communicate the importance of trust in diversified, domain-specific knowledge, even as we retain the ability to call out corruption or error in our scientific disciplines? And should part of that strategy be shouting, "We're trying to help, you morons," at the top of our lungs?
I don't think that that last thing would probably help.
Sometimes you wonder if it might.
Sometimes you do it anyway.
Sometimes the fact that you're thinking about doing it, people pick up on, and they get mad just at the fact
just
that
they can tell you're thinking
it. They can tell you're thinking
it. Yeah. No, it's hard not to feel it, hard not to think it. I think about this all the time. It's really hard. Like, the reality is that, like, science is so complex and kind of boring. Like, we were just talking about, you know, disaster preparedness. Like, all the little, or your car accident. You know, like, all the little things where we've done the math and this was worth doing. Mm-hmm. To save a life. But as part of that, you have to be like, okay, well, what? How much is a life worth then? Like, what are the, we have to just, like, we have limited resources. We have limited human time to do things to highways. What are we going to spend that money on? And then, so in order to do that, you have to, like, have a scientist somewhere who's like, I've calculated that a human life is worth X. And you're like, that's not how that works. Yeah. Like, that's not, like, so there's all these, like, abstractions. There's all these, like, ways in which scientists have conversations that aren't really about the conversation. Mm-hmm. They're about, like, a big sort of story of the field. And in order to have those conversations, you have to know a ton about that particular field. And even somebody who is, like, an astrophysicist is not going to be able to have, like, good conversations about, you know, the cost-benefit analysis of highway safety.
You know what I've been I have it described a video you made over and over and over again to very many people since you made it. It was one of the most clarifying. The amount of people you have helped through not yelling or trying to help you, Morris, is incalculable. The video you made about information comparing the internet to the printing press.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly lucid analogy that I think is really wise. One of the things that made me think about was there's a place called the Grolier Club in New York that is a great private museum about the history of publishing. And it's really helpful because we think about the great written works of history and they often sit in a vacuum. And what this museum does is talk about the history of who published that. Like your favorite Greek philosophers are your favorite Greek philosophers because they were the favorite Greek philosophers of these Italian Renaissance publishers. Mm-hmm. And the history of what information gets shared and what is antiquity? Well, antiquity has been curated for you by other more recent parts of antiquity, right? And within that, the fascinating part of it, at least for me, was the idea of the corruption of the Catholic Church at the time of the Reformation and being like, there are absolutely things to oppose within this corrupt institution. Also, here's the Malleus Maleficarum, which there's a copy of at this place called the Grolier Club. And I think one of the most haunting things that happened to me when I looked at that was knowing that all of that is the most made up, murderous nightmare fuel on the planet. And there's like 800 pages of it.
Yeah. And so this was like the top selling book for like over 100 years. And it was basically a book of how do you find and kill witches?
How do you find and kill witches? And what was insane about it was you, like in my head, I go like, well, this book is a thinly veiled pretext for historical, bigoted, murderous violence. And there's hundreds of pages of being like, okay, you gotta get this right. You know, like you gotta get this right. And you're like, you're making it up. You're having a civilization-wide hallucination based in murderous intent.
and people going, yeah, but you got to cross your T's and dot your I's when you're having a made up murder nightmare. Mm-hmm. You know, like that is really hard to stomach and to contend with.
Whenever I feel the sensation of, God damn it, you morons, we're just trying to help. Mm-hmm. I know that there's something going wrong in my head because like those people aren't morons. Those are people. They have a different experience and probably I would be like them if I had had their experience, you know? Mm-hmm. The way that I kind of get out of that is I'm like, oh, we're babies. Mm-hmm. Like we have been doing many-to-many communication for maybe 15 years, you know, like at a global scale. Like I've been doing it for longer, but like global scale, a lot of people are like pretty new to the internet. We don't have norms. We don't have taboos. We don't have ways of handling this. And it was the exact same thing with every communications revolution ever, which is all of the systems that were like imperfect, kind of broken, but chugging along, just get ripped down. And like long-term, that can be good.
Yeah.
Because there are a bunch of like ways in which, you know, I'm not happy about how academia works.
Yeah.
And it makes sense. Like a lot of the critiques make sense. Like sometimes people will say to me, they'll be like, well, but this guy's ideas are pretty good. Like it is really true that a lot of the root of our health problems is the food system. And I'm like, yeah. And like doctors don't focus on that enough, maybe. They definitely talk to me about it.
Yeah.
You know, my doctor talks to me about food. Like I feel like most people don't like to hear from their doctor about food because it's like, yeah, I know, man. Like it's just not revolutionary information. It's like, yeah, I should eat like a grown-up, but I don't.
It's the weaponizing of like a relationship to expertise, which is people don't like being, people, well, and also let me nail down, Americans in particular do not like being told what to do.
Yeah.
It is a potent part of our cultural makeup. And it's this crazy thing, like you're saying, where it's not that there are not elements of corruption or error in individual experts or institutions that attempt to cultivate expertise, but you end up with this horrifying thing. You know what I thought about this a lot was the skepticism, which is what we're talking about, right? Skepticism in the concept of expertise in the journey of becoming a father, being with my wife in terms of a journey of a pregnancy and labor and delivery. And you have this moment where you approach a for-profit medical industry whose decisions are occasionally, instead of being rooted in patient care, are rooted in profit motive, hospital bylaws and regulations. And occasionally, even if it's not profit motive or something as sort of like sinister as profit motive, maybe the decisions are rooted in hyper fear of litigation, right? Like fear of litigiousness, where it's still, that's not quite what's the best care option for me, but you've been advised by a lawyer to do it that way.
Yeah.
And you look for someone, because if you're having your first child, it's like, I can't be an expert in this. I don't know medicine. Someone help me. And someone comes along to help you.
Right.
And they're like, you should be skeptical of X, Y, and Z. Also, if you got some crystals,
and you go,
there is something to be skeptical of here. Please don't tell me to get crystals.
Yeah. And we want agency. You know, this is something I see a lot in chemotherapy denial. Like this is something I care a lot about and sort of follow on the internet, where people they'll have a conversation with their doctor and the doctor will basically say, oh, it doesn't really matter what you eat.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, I can't accept that as a possible truth.
Don't
like,
you understand that a ritual will give me a feeling of control?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what people want is to feel like they have some agency over their world. And the reality is that it kind of can matter what you eat. Like you should eat healthy if you can when you are doing chemotherapy. There are times when you should eat whatever you can, because that's part of being healthy, is just getting calories in you.
Yeah.
But if you're able to eat well, then absolutely do it. And nowadays we have so many ways to control a lot of the symptoms of chemotherapy that I probably should have eaten healthier while I was doing chemo. And I mostly didn't because I was sad, not because I was nauseous.
Yeah, man.
But you know, that was also fine. Giving people agency is really important. People feeling agency is really important. But I do think that like academia is sort of primed to be attacked because it's like a bunch of people who are like, getting their money from the government. Like, why do these rich people get handouts? They like have tenure so they can never lose their job. They're literally in like institutions that are separate from society, like kind of intentionally separated from society. There's like all kinds of ways that science in particular is easy to attack.
Yeah.
And I think that another way is that people in academia don't go out into the rest of their community. Like they're not in like Rotary clubs anymore. They're not at the Elks Lodge. They're in their own academic societies in a way that they didn't used to be. And that is in addition to, I think, this communications revolution, which is the biggest effect. I think that anything that we can do to be like part of our broader societies actually is healing in this.
Yeah.
It lets people be like, oh, so like I'm kind of okay with attacking Harvard, but like not my university where Dave works.
Yeah.
You know?
It's funny because there's an immediate analogy in my head to housing and having like one of the good civic laws they have is about taking affordable units and interspersing them so that like, you, in other words, that being like, yeah, there's available housing intermingled through. We don't have this like intense class striation where all the richies live here and all the poors live here. Similarly to that idea of like, yeah, your academic circle should be out. This interesting thing, I grew up around doing LARP and nerd stuff is actually nerdy stuff is, you know, D&D, LARP is a place where you actually see a real intersection of STEM nerds and humanities nerds. And it's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because I think there is something that I don't know what the how to get over the hurdle, but it is true that having truth seeking as a personality trait creates friction in social circles. Because I think that there is just, if you're around someone who actually is like a human rights lawyer or like, or people that like are like labor organizers, you're like, wow, that guy who fights bad people all day, every day, can be confrontational. And you're like, yeah, that. Thank God, of course, it, and would have to be. You can't be a little cinnamon bun and have that. I mean, maybe you can have, there's a million different kinds of people, but I've seen in my life, like, in the same way, you're hanging out with somebody and you're like, I just went through this, you know, like, bad breakup, and this is sort of how I'm feeling. I think it was the other person's fault. And your friend, who maybe has a scientific mind, is like, what makes you think it was just not your fault?
Yeah,
you go like, I don't need this from you.
That's not the conversation I want to have.
But it's hard. I think that like the tools we have for our callings are sometimes personality things that can, I don't know, it's challenging.
Curiosity is so powerful and so good.
Yeah.
But it's easy to have it in the direction that like makes you feel good, you know?
Yeah.
And what we have now is such a system that will provide the ability to satisfy your curiosity in ways that are more about how do I get views on this content than how do I say true things.
Yeah.
And if there's demand for ways to be curious that lead you away from the truth and that, you know, that make it so that you get to feel superior, you get to feel agency, those curiosity, those rabbit holes can be built for people to fall down.
I think that's the hardest part is navigating through people that have said, that maybe have arrived at a conclusion, like have an interior model of reality that has a massive hole in it. They believe something that is potentially harmful to their own health and the health of people around them about medicine or science or politics or culture or the world or their fellow human beings. And you go, I have the specialized knowledge to know you are wrong. And I'm finding a way to make that known to you that does not make you feel like shit in a way that makes you just tell me to shut up.
So hard. And so there's two books that I tell you to read. One is called High Conflict by Amanda Ripley. Very sort of like about how people get stuck, all of us, like including ourselves, like me, get stuck in ways of thinking. And it's very hard to get them out and like how people do get out, which is mostly just talking to each other and listening to each other, which is oftentimes the thing you don't want to do. And then there's other called How Minds Change, which is really about like what actually does cause someone to change their mind about something, which does happen.
Yeah.
But it's pretty unusual. And so like there are specific circumstances under which it happens.
There's some writer that I follow that has said a great element about basically like it is simultaneously true that it is very unusual for people to change their minds. And if you have a 90-minute conversation with someone about a thing that they normally don't talk about, that will be the most access to another. Like in other words, being it was a person who was a former labor organizer who was again saying like, yes, people rarely change. People are very stuck in their ways. Also, most people aren't doing anything other than talking about this with a few people that they know already agree with them.
Yeah.
If you have one conversation with somebody for an hour about a thing they haven't considered, it will probably be the most exposure they have that year.
Yeah.
Right? On the average person, right? It was very a very well put thing, and I think it was very hope inspiring.
And we have one more question. I'm sad.
I could do this all day, baby. This question is, which candy could I live on as my sole source of sustenance for the longest time with the best health outcomes? And I swear to God, Hank, it better be a real candy in there and not some crazy British candy that's actually a superfood.
Okay. This is, I'm glad that you put that qualification in there because in fact, that is a limitation I put on myself.
Yes.
That I couldn't like go searching other cultures. It has to be a candy in my grocery store.
Yep.
So we talk about a lot of heavy stuff today.
Yes.
This, I think—
The flapping arms
was
thing.
Was the thing that I spent the most time on.
You're a science educator, and you spend more time on which candy can I eat all day than the one about how
I just wanted to talk to you about that.
I know. There's no fucking answer. Got to figure it out. Keep on trucking.
So I know you're not going to like this.
I you never tell me my business.
These are gummy vitamins, which are absolutely candy, right? So this was my first instinct. Gummy vitamins have all of the vitamins and minerals you need. And if you were to live on just gummy vitamins, you might die today because you'd have to eat 2,000 calories of them. And depending on the gummy vitamins you choose, you might get iron poisoning. Iron would shut down. What's the serving size? I'm not going to let him eat more than the serving size.
One gummy bear.
This is for kids.
Oh, two gummy bears. I would die?
So these wouldn't kill you, but an adult gummy vitamin would kill you because okay. It would have iron in it.
Gotcha.
You get iron poisoning. That interferes with your mitochondria's ability to make ATP. Did you have three?
I had a second.
You are a little bigger than a child.
Okay. Just ever so slightly.
And you're right, you couldn't make ATP. You also, your liver would filter it out. It might trigger a bunch of reactions in your liver. Your liver might die that day. So you could die in a day if you ate 2,000 calories of adult gummy vitamins, which is why I bought children's gummy vitamins.
This is also why you shouldn't eat iron shavings.
Yeah. I mean, a little bit is fine. You need some iron. Iron's good for you.
You need some, not too
but
much.
There's a Goldilocks zone. If you don't have any, very bad. If you have too much, very bad. Too much is actually worse than not enough.
Too much, worse than not. Okay, gotcha. Yes,
but it's hard to eat. You'd have to eat 2,000 calories of gummy vitamins, which is, I think, more than is in this container.
Is that in the candy aisle?
No, but also even without, so this is my first thought. And we're going to, it turns out, you're right. So it doesn't matter. This also will kill you. Children's gummy vitamins will kill you faster than just eating gummy bears.
Wow.
Because of vitamin
A
poisoning.
Eating the vitamins will kill you faster than normal gummy bears?
Yeah, because they have all the vitamins in them. And you will get...
I knew vitamins were bad. I knew it.
Just because something is good doesn't mean that it's infinitely good, right? So
The dose makes the poison.
And vitamin A poisoning after a few weeks or maybe up to 2 months just eating this, I think probably weeks. I don't think you'd get months. You probably have organ failure. So liver problems, your skin, you'd have like skin problems. You'd have intracranial pressure, bone pain from vitamin A poisoning. There's a bunch of others but I think the vitamin A poisoning would be the most acute. So like the thing that would get you first.
Just picturing like a Cormac McCarthy, the road situation with some guy, lesions on his skin, just popping these gummy bears.
Oh, being
like, I'm going to live forever. Just like so frightening. Ooh.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
So gummy vitamins wouldn't do it. Are they in the candy aisle? Obviously no. They are a candy, but they're not in the candy aisle. So let's limit ourselves to the candy aisle. We're actually going to do better than gummy vitamins.
I hope so. You said die today. I hope we do better than that. I'm never going to eat a vitamin again.
It's an important exercise to recognize that the dose makes the poison. So do you have a thought? Because there is, I think, an objectively true answer.
I know which one I would feel doable on like an emotional level. But my body is telling me what the answer is.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's marketing or not.
Is your body telling you about any of these?
Oh, that's awesome.
It's basically just eating peanuts. So one of your big problems is going to be protein.
Yeah.
You get no protein in your diet, you are going to die of protein deficiency in months, probably.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, so what's got protein in the candy aisle? It's mostly things with peanuts. That also gives you a little bit of fiber, gives you the fat, which you're going to get in the candy aisle anytime you're going in a bar direction rather than just a chewy sugar treat. It's going to give you the carbs, obviously. So you're going to have like a fairly good mix. Now, peanuts, unfortunately, are not a complete protein source.
Okay.
So you will still, eventually, if you only have peanuts, the protein will not totally be taken care of. But that actually isn't going to be what gets you with these. And I think that this is actually, maybe surprisingly, a little bit better because the chocolate is going to bring some nutrients with it that the payday with no chocolate isn't going to bring. So in here, you got some iron, you got some potassium, you got some calcium. And enough that if you ate just this, probably get your dailies of those. But not a vitamin D, so you just have to go outside more. Sun, get that. But neither of these have vitamin C. And in fact, I can find nothing in the candy aisle that has vitamin C, with the possible exception of like a fruit roll-up.
Yeah.
And that isn't going to have any protein, so you're going to die of that. But with peanut M&Ms, you probably are going to live about a year, which is a long time for one food.
Wow.
Yeah, but then you will die of scurvy.
Yar. Wow. Oh, my God.
And I have this now?
No, of course. There was a fright just before you got here. Someone brought up Mounds or Almond Joy, which have coconut in it. And coconut does have vitamin C, but I looked it up and I was almost sent somebody to go get an Almond Joy real fast. Because I thought about this so long and I didn't even consider Almond Joy because I hate coconut.
Wow.
It's such a terrible texture to my
mouth. Is it a similar
mouth.
Vitamin C issue? Or
it turns out that it would be good. The protein content is way lower in Almond Joy, even though it does have some almonds, but it has way fewer. So it'd be very difficult to get enough protein. You'd have to eat like 5,000 to 10,000 calories of Almond Joys. But then it also turns out that the amount of vitamin C, once they like dry and sugar the coconut, is very, very low. So not enough. You'd still get scurvy. Maybe you'd be last a little longer, but.
Damn, yeah. Scurvy's going to get me.
Yeah.
So all we need is to petition
the Mars Company.
The Mars Company to make peanut M&Ms with little chunks of orange in there. And I'm gonna live forever.
Yeah. You would live in that case probably for years. So maybe like up to 2 or 3 years before the protein deficiency got you, of not getting all of the essential amino acids.
Mars Corporation. Peanut M&Ms, little chunks of orange, little chunks of meat.
I can't believe, honestly, I can't believe there's no beef jerky M&Ms yet. They're trying everything.
Coming to you soon, M&Ms, little chunks. I love my little chunks.
A little bits of man in there.
I want you to picture me walking away from this recording,
Scarfing
down peanut-based candies, getting in my spacesuit, flapping my arms 100 times a second to get the altitude to dive straight through a vacuum chamber out the other side of the planet where I bring a message of peace, love, and understanding where we accept expertise and human knowledge throughout the planet.
And then you punch a baby.
And then I don't punch a baby. I punch like I'm going for the baby and then clock Elon Musk right in the head. Bam, gone. What happened to Mars? I thought we were sending you assholes to Mars. Get out of here. They're bad for the country and the world.
And now it's time for my least favorite part of the show, which is where it ends. Not just because I enjoy recording it so much, especially with someone as fun as you. So Brennan, thank you for joining. Thank you for watching. Brennan, what are you up to? Where can people find you?
You can find me on dropout.tv, where I will be making Dimension 20. And I'm also a Game Changer and Make Some Noise, a bunch of other amazing shows on dropout.tv.
My comedy special is on there.
Hank's comedy special, Amazing, is on there. You can find me as a player to be on Abria Iyengar's campaign coming soon to Worlds Beyond Number, hit podcast Worlds Beyond Number. And October 2nd is the premiere of Campaign 4 Critical Role, which I will be GMing.
Man has never said no.
While the sun is out, make hay. I will keep going. There is no limit.
Same.
There is no limit.
If you want to give me some homework to learn more about the world, you can ask me questions in the comments. If you see questions that you like, you can upvote them, and I will answer a few of them over the next few days. And if you haven't already, please subscribe. It's youtube.com/complexly is where we are. You can subscribe. You can see more of Asking Anything. We have so many episodes for season 2. And also, there will be yet more things here on this channel, which I'm very excited about. Thank you for watching. Thank you for asking me questions. And thank you for being here. Thank you to everybody who helped make this episode. If you've been watching or listening and you have some questions, you can leave them in the comments. If you see questions that you like, you can upvote those. I'll answer a few of them in the next few days. Also, if you want to see more of what we're up to, you can join the Complexly newsletter by visiting complexly.com.